story emerged over the weekend. The headline in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch read, Episcopalians reject three gays for bishop. Was it about 2 years ago we were talking about the Episcopal Church USA with one gay bishop, Gene Robinson? He was elected, and then in really a flurry of media attention over the course of the next 6 months, consecrated and then appointed to be bishop. And that story stuck around for quite some time. Apparently, it wasn't the end of things out on the West Coast. There were candidates for a bishopric, and three of them were gay. They were not elected, and that becomes a story now. So the standard of what we're reporting by way of who gets elected as bishop in the Episcopal Church USA and who doesn't has changed a little bit since the Bishop Gene Robinson story. We'll be talking about that here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. with Bishop Keith Ackerman of Forward in Faith North America. He's bishop of the Diocese of Quincy over the river in Illinois. That's the first half hour of the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. We are coming to you live. We're back live with you this Tuesday, and we're going to have a full week of Issues Etc. We're planning on going all the way through Friday, have a rare Friday Issues Etc. And we're back live with you on this Tuesday. It's already the ninth day of May, for heaven's sakes, and I must wish my son happy birthday. Today he's 10 years old. He has hit double digits. Actually, tonight about 10 minutes to 11, he'll hit double digits. And he's not going to let us celebrate until he's actually, truly 10 years old. So I'm not going to let him stay up until that late. So he's just going to have to settle for something a little earlier than that. So happy birthday to my son on his 10th. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're going to spend some time at from 4 to 4:30 in audio open lines. Joel Osteen was on the Today Show this morning. Katie Couric, they had a little interview on his latest book. It's coming out in about a year. And actually even had him respond to some of his critics. So we'll be hearing some of that from the Today Show during audio open lines. Then coming up, I'm sorry, that'll be at 4 o'clock, but before 4 o'clock, from 3:30 to 4, we're going to be talking with David Stevens, Dr. David Stevens, of the Christian Medical Association, about a campaign that has been launched by the nation's largest gynecologist group aimed at increasing access to the morning after pill. They're pretty steamed about it. We'll find out what the group is all about with David Stevens then. Audio open lines, and then at 4:30, we'll be talking with Dr. Nathan Jastrom. Today, the church remembers Job. And we'll talk about Job. Boy, a lot of people get confused by the book of Job. We'll find out what it's really all about. From 5:30 until 6, I'm sorry, from 5 to 5:30, I'm getting ahead of myself. Dr. Doug Grotheis will be our guest from Denver Seminary. How do you write a letter to the editor? I mean, write a letter to the editor that not only gets mailed and delivered and perhaps opened, but read, taken seriously, perhaps even published. We'll talk about that with Doug Grotheis. Then from 5:30 to 6, some more audio open lines. There's a 60 Minutes piece on one of the major elements in the whole drama of the Da Vinci Code, the Priory of Sion. Ed Bradley actually went over to France, looked up the documents, and uncovered some things about the Priory of Sion that you might not read in the Da Vinci Code. Again, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Bishop Keith Ackerman has been on the program before. He's bishop of the Diocese of Quincy in Illinois, and he's president of Forward in Faith North America. He joins us to talk about this rejection this weekend of three homosexual candidates to become the next bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of California. Bishop Ackerman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks, Todd. Good to hear your voice again. I hope you've been well.
Before we get into some questions for you, let's listen to a piece that was a report this weekend on the election of the bishop in the Episcopal Diocese of California from National Public Radio.
In San Francisco today, lay people and clergy from the Episcopal Church met to elect the next bishop for the Bay Area. Among the seven candidates were three openly gay clergy. The election has drawn worldwide attention because the appointment of a second homosexual bishop in the American Episcopal Church threatens to split the parent body, the Anglican Communion. Reporter Marjorie Sun has been at the San Francisco convention, and she joins me now. Marjorie, I understand the voting has just been completed. Who was elected?
They elected the Reverend Mark Andrus. He's a straight male from the Diocese of Alabama. He's already a bishop, an associate bishop. He was the highest-ranking clergy among the seven candidates.
And the Reverend Andrus, any particular reason you believe that he was the one who was chosen?
Well, he is more of the same in that he's straight and male. He's also, he gets to wear the purple shirt because he is already a bishop. So he brings that seniority to the position. The others were solid in their leadership skills as well. There was one candidate actually from the National Cathedral. But it's interesting that none of the gay candidates got a significant number of votes. From the first ballot, the highest vote among the clergy voting was about 20%.
And why do you think that is, given the controversy over whether there would be a gay bishop or not? Why do you think that the gay candidates didn't attract much support?
Well, two women that I talked to who were lay representatives of their Martinez parishes said to me that sexuality did factor into their vote, that they didn't want to add more controversy to the Episcopal Church or to the worldwide Anglican Communion. Another man that I talked to who was a lay representative said that to him, to have a gay representative in as bishop would have been against his beliefs. But it looks as though, from the votes, that it wasn't a factor, that sexuality was not a major factor for most of the delegates in the lay vote and in the clergy vote.
Well, quickly, that's something the rest of us focused on. What is at stake for this election in California and the church there?
Well, what's at stake for the local diocese is that there are churches that are dwindling in membership. There are needs for a few more churches to consolidate, and there are fundraising needs. And I think people were concentrating on the credentials of the candidates and not their sexuality to meet those local needs.
Thank you, Marjorie. Reporter Marjorie Sun joined us from San Francisco.
That's a story from National Public Radio over the weekend about these elections in California for bishop out there. Three candidates who were gay didn't seem to make much of a showing. The one who was elected is Bishop-elect Andrus. Bishop Ackerman, I was interested that Andrus is being was described there as more of the same, straight and male. What does that say to you?
Well, Todd, that's an intriguing question, actually, the way you've put it, because one of the great realities is, in reading some of the pressure groups that have been working on this matter, such as Integrity, which is the homosexual caucus, is that this was extraordinarily important that they elect someone who would be able to advance that minority position that they hold within the Anglican Communion. And the interesting thing is that the statement that was made by Integrity after the election of Bishop Andrus was highly complimentary and positive about his leadership in and with the homosexual community, so that he is quite noted for his advocacy. So in one sense, with that in the minds of everybody in California, that he would be highly supportive of the homosexual agenda. The other part of it was, how can we do that without causing unusual division? And the result of the candidates' names being released a couple of months ago was that the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, issued an immediate statement reminding the Anglican Communion that we have all agreed that we would not proceed by electing and approving and consecrating homosexual people for ordination and consecration. So it would have been such a blatant response had one of the three candidates been elected that it would have been inevitable that there would have been a rather significant outcry. At this point, what that means is life can continue as it has in the Diocese of California in terms of the perspectives out there, but it would also mean that an imminent split is not quite as quite upon us.
So what would it have meant? I mean, now in retrospect, of course, it seems moot because none of the three gay candidates for bishop there in California really made much of a showing in the election. But what would it have meant for the Episcopal Church USA in its California diocese to have elected another gay bishop?
Well, first of all, one of the major tasks of the General Convention this June is to apologize to the rest of the Anglican Communion for what we did 3 years ago in electing, approving, and consecrating homosexual bishops. And so I guess that really would have put it into a whole new dimension had we proceeded in doing essentially the same thing. Moreover, one of the things that is so extraordinary is hardly ever do we go to a general convention to approve candidates for bishop. In other words, there is another way in which this is done between general conventions that is in that three-year period. But the last time we did it was for Gene Robinson, so it went to general convention, and this time California's was going to general convention. Hardly ever do we do that. Generally speaking, what that means is that each standing committee of every diocese approves elections, sends their consents, then the bishops do the same. And it's all done in paper. It's all paper ballots. It's all sent out. It's all accomplished within a month, and you don't hear much about it. So if you go back and look at the number of times this has been done at General Convention, you'll find not often unless somebody's trying to prove a point.
So this was done, is it fair to say, Bishop, in the most public way possible?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. No question.
Now, that apology that you mentioned, you said one of the major tasks that the Episcopal Church USA will face in General Convention is issuing apology for the election consecration of Gene Robinson. Do you think that apology really will be forthcoming the next time the Episcopal Church meets generally?
No, I really don't. I think what's going to happen, based on some things I've read, is that there will be some language that will show a sense of regret. But I think that there are several ways to express regret and sorrow. One is, I'm terribly sorry for what I did. I didn't know it was going to have such repercussions. Another way is to say, I'm sorry you took it that way. And the third is to be able to say something like, we're independent. Why do you have a right to tell us what we ought to be doing? And that last position has been one of the real eye-openers for the average Episcopalian who has thought that the Episcopal Church is an American denomination that can do whatever it wishes and seems oftentimes to forget it. It's one of the smallest provinces of the Anglican Communion, and it really has to function within the bounds of what is approved every 10 years at the Lambeth Conference. And the Lambeth Conference has not met since 98, when it was very, very clear about its position on human sexuality. And the Archbishop of Canterbury has regularly reiterated that's the position of the Anglican Communion, no matter what a particular province may presume to do.
Even if there were an apology made the next time the Episcopal Church USA meets to the Anglican Communion, we're sorry about Gene Robinson, as long as Gene Robinson is still acting as bishop in New Hampshire, what kind of apology could that be?
A weak one. I think it's not a very sincere apology.
Now, in the paper, the moratorium that was encouraged by the Anglican Communion on the consecration of gay bishops is called temporary. Mm-hmm. Is there a next step planned here? Is everyone waiting in the Anglican Communion to see what the Episcopal Church USA does next? Or where do you think the Anglican Communion has a mind to go on this issue?
In anticipation of how General Convention may act or not act, the Archbishop of Canterbury has put together a commission. That commission is going to review everything that has taken place at General Convention, and it'll do so this summer. Then the primates, that would be the archbishops of each one of the provinces in the world, we being one of the exceptions, we don't have an archbishop, we have a presiding bishop who until recently technically only presided over the House of Bishops, but now is treated as if he were a primate. The primates all then get together, and then they discuss what steps would need to take place if there were any other violations. Moreover, any province that finds violations taking place can file a complaint with what is, in effect, a board of review that has been put together by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Finally, in 2008, when the Lambeth Conference meets again, the primates of, I mean, all of the bishops of the Anglican world will gather. And here's one of the tricky points, and that is that there are already bishops in the Anglican Communion who have said that if Bishop Vicky Jean Robinson does, in fact, come to the to the Lambeth Conference, they won't come because that would be a violation of their understanding of the episcopate. So it's really a mess, and I really am objectively reporting this. I mean, it is quite extraordinary, the chaos in the Anglican world. And the reality is that it's, in many, many instances, presented as if it were a civil rights issue or even a rights issue. And that's not the way the Anglican Communion is dealing with this. They are seeing this as a matter of what 1 Timothy and Titus have to say about what is expected of a bishop.
An ecclesiastical issue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, you just mentioned something in passing there. Presiding Bishop Frank Griswold is has been lately, you said, being treated like he is a primate. What's changed?
What happened is this is much less than 100 years ago. The senior bishop was, in fact, the senior bishop of the Episcopal Church was the presiding bishop. And what makes one of the things of the Episcopal Church somewhat unique is when we go to General Convention, there will be two houses. There will be the House of Deputies, which will be presided over by a priest, Dean George Werner, and then there's the House of Bishops, presided over by the presiding bishop. And there isn't a situation whereby the presiding bishop would function as an archbishop, which would mean that he would convene the General Convention, he would speak to both houses of General Convention. There has to be a special action for the two houses even to meet together. And then there's even legislation that requires concurrence by the House. So it's very much like the national government in the United States, but with a president of the United States. And you see, what's happened is so that the presiding bishop can have a place at the table. Not too many years ago, we tacked on the title primate to presiding bishop. But in fact, the way in which he functions is very different from the way in which archbishops in the rest of the world function. The other thing that's fascinating is there are only two primates in the entire Anglican Communion that don't have their own diocese, Canada and the United States, the two most rapidly shrinking provinces in the Anglican world.
It sounds as though, at least from that perspective and the other things we've been talking about so far here, Bishop Ackerman, the Episcopal Church USA, as it exists as a sector of the Anglican Communion, does things its own way.
That is correct. In fact, what is also quite embarrassing to us is when we go over there in 2008, we will go over as one of the smallest provinces, but with the most bishops, most number of bishops. So in other words, the Episcopal Church can pretty much sway things at Lambeth Conference because we have so many more bishops than the rest of the Anglican world. But if the irony, of course, is that we don't have nearly the same number of people in the pews.
There's a cloud of tension really since the Gene Robinson consecration that has followed presiding Bishop Frank Griswold around, especially as he relates to the other primates or presiding bishops in the Anglican Communion. He apparently signed the moratorium on the future consecration of gay bishops when he met with the other bishops at Lambeth.
Yes.
And yet seems to kind of play a completely different role on that issue when he's back here in America in his own province.
Yes.
So how does he represent, or how does he if he does at all, explain this to the rest of the Anglican Communion, that he's laying hands on Gene Robinson in his consecration service shortly after signing a document saying no one should be laying hands on Gene Robinson.
Because he and a number of Episcopalians think that the Constitution and canons of the Episcopal Church override everything else. And you see, the Constitution and canons of the Episcopal Church are only designed to handle the ordering of a province. They aren't meant to change doctrine and dogma, and that's a new wrinkle to the Constitution and canons in the Episcopal Church. The most significant wrinkles have been, A, making a national church. We weren't set up as a national church. We were set up as dioceses in communion with each other. Then we all had our own property, each diocese. So wrinkle number one is now we have a presiding bishop who's also called a primate. Wrinkle number two is we are now hearing the term national church when, in fact, there is no such thing as a national church. What there is a national church headquarters and a general convention. But we don't have the same system. And third of all, the third wrinkle is that we have begun saying that the Episcopal Church holds property in trust for all the dioceses. But that's ludicrous, because I can buy and sell property in my diocese without asking anybody about it except my standing committee in my own diocese. So it's very peculiar to watch an emergence of a whole new polity, which has ended in the trouble we're in today, where we've become so extraordinarily independent from the rest of the Anglican world, which is the final new wrinkle.
With only 30 seconds, no more, what do you expect the role of Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, what do you expect his role or his position to be, if any different than what it is today, on this issue of the consecration of gay bishops?
I've known Rowan Williams for years. And now that he's the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's not the academic professor that he's been, because he's truly an academic, I would have to say that he is in the same position Thomas Becket was in with Henry II. And that is, when he became the Archbishop of Canterbury, he had to enforce the Word of God and the law of God over and against everything else.
Bishop Keith Ackerman is Bishop of the Diocese of Quincy in Illinois, and he's President of Forward in Faith North America. Their website, you can find it, called forwardinfaith.com. Forward in Faith, it's a reform group within the Anglican Communion, the Episcopal Church USA. Forwardinfaith.com. Bishop Ackerman, thanks for taking the time and being our guest.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, and God bless you, and God bless all of your listeners.
And you as well. When we come back from this break, second half hour of the program, we're going to spend with Dr. David Stevens of the Christian Medical Association. We're going to talk about a campaign on the part of the largest gynecological group aimed at increasing access to morning after pills. Stay tuned.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The reformer Martin Luther and his theology have been understood and misunderstood for almost 500 years. Was Luther's theology merely warmed over Roman Catholicism? Was Luther a Protestant? How important were the ideas of sin, grace, and the justification of the sinner to Luther's thought, theology, and Reformation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, A Theology to Live By, right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for A Theology to Live By.
How can we increase the number of pro-life voices in Washington?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Despite being vastly outspent by abortion rights groups, including Emily's List, MoveOn.org, and Planned Parenthood PAC, the number of winning pro-life candidates endorsed by the Susan B. Anthony List Candidate Fund has increased in the past four elections. In 2004, we won 27 of 35 races. How did we do it? By mobilizing our nationwide network of over 140,000 members in all 50 states. With your support, we can do even better. Help us put more voices for life in Washington. Join the Susan B. Anthony List today.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. For my wife, Diane, I put the dishes in the dishwasher. For her, I emptied the dishwasher, but later was told she couldn't find where I had put things. For her, I didn't yank the sheets in the middle of the night, but let her have more than half. For her, I made the bed in the morning. For her, I surrender the remote. For her, I watch HGTV and Food Network. For her, I tag along while she shops. For her, I don't say anything about my money worries. For her, I don't ask, why in the world did you do it that way? For her, and to her, I apologize, even though I know I am right. Let's face it, the woman is blessed. For Diane, I've done all those things and many others that I can't think of. I've done all those things at least once, some even twice, over 30 years of marriage. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Ephesians 5:25. Christ's love for us is once, complete, and for all time. Assuming you husbands can identify with me, what might happen if we think more about Christ's love and model it to our wives? Maybe we'd have to apologize less and get the remote more often.
The St. Louis-Stuttgart Volksmarch Club will offer two separate walking trails during the Memorial Day weekend. The walks, scheduled for Saturday, May 27th and Sunday, May 28th, will wind through two different South St. Louis neighborhoods. Registration for both folks walks will take place in Wilmart Park at picnic site number 2, located off Hampton near Jameson Avenue. This Memorial Day, take time for a folks walk. For more information, contact the St. Louis Stuttgart Folks March Club.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the second half hour, Dr. David Stevens joins us to talk about a campaign that was launched by the nation's largest group of gynecologists aimed at increasing access to the morning after pill. Now, the morning after pill, a lot of doctors would like to see it go on the shelves and be non-prescription. At present, it is a prescription drug. The FDA says it's a prescription drug. So, there are those who are saying, and they seem to be in a position to know, I mean, the largest group of gynecologists in the nation saying, no, we should have access to this. It's safe. Let's get the story from NBC's Nightly News, and then we'll welcome Dr. David Stevens, executive director of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee, for his reaction. Here's the story from NBC Nightly News on this.
We are back with NBC News In Depth tonight. Another shot in the culture wars today. A prominent doctors group slammed the Bush administration for keeping a contraceptive pill called Plan B from being sold over the counter in this country. Plan B has been on the market since 1999 in a prescription version. About 1.3 million prescriptions are written for it each year, and over the last 3 years, usage has gone up 200%. It is against that backdrop that the doctors weighed in today and their critics fired right back. Our report tonight from NBC News Chief Science Correspondent Robert Bazell.
Plan B is actually two pills. Taken within 72 hours of unprotected sex, it prevents pregnancy. But some people, mostly political conservatives, think it should not be readily available, especially to teenagers.
It's a morning after type thing, and so they feel safe that they can be promiscuous and patch it up the next day.
Plan B is sold by prescription. The FDA's external and staff scientific advisors have said it should be sold over the counter, but the agency is refusing to allow that.
the despicable treatment of women at the hands of the FDA over this issue.
In a strong statement today, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists said the FDA is wrong, motivated by politics, and the group started a campaign urging doctors to give women prescriptions for the pills now.
That they may use if necessary, and to urge them to use it if one of those accidents happen.
There is another argument against Plan B, besides concerns about promoting promiscuity. The Roman Catholic Church has long been opposed to many forms of contraception. Now other groups are joining that opposition, focusing on Plan B. The argument is that Plan B prevents a fertilized egg from implanting in the womb. Dr. Charmaine Yost of the Conservative Family Research Council says women should be told that is an abortion.
When a drug is being presented to them as being only a contraceptive device, when in actual fact it does sometimes function to create an abortion, we find that to be very troubling.
But the gynecologist group says not only is that claim scientifically wrong, Plan B over-the-counter would actually reduce abortions.
We estimate that if it's readily available, it can prevent up to 50% of the abortions, pregnancy terminations in this country.
It is a dispute for which few people see any resolution soon. Robert Bazell, NBC News, New York.
All right, that's the story from NBC Nightly News last night on this campaign launched by the nation's largest gynecologist group aimed at increasing access to the morning after pill. Dr. David Stevens joins us, executive director of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee, for his reaction and to answer some questions. Dr. Stevens, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be with you, Todd.
What is your basic concern about the morning after pill?
Well, it's hard to pick just one. I think the bottom line issue is the one they mentioned in the report, and that fact is that there is clear and compelling evidence that part of the time this works by actually preventing the implantation of a developing human being in the uterus. Now, how does the premier obstetrician and gynecological organization in the country get away with saying that this is not an abortifacient? Well, in other words, causing abortions. The way they did that happened many years ago. In the 1960s, they changed the definition of pregnancy. Instead of saying that pregnancy, Todd, begins when fertilization happens, which is what most of us would think, when I have the sperm go into an egg and a new human being is formed, there's a new human being that needs to be valued and protected. What they've said instead is pregnancy doesn't start until that embryo implants in the womb. Therefore, if you do something that prevents implantation, it's not really an abortion. And so what that does is give a lot of women a false sense of security when they're presented with this pill that is just preventing pregnancy, when actually what it's doing a good part of the time, probably around 40% of the time, is destroying a developing human being.
40% of the time. What, if you could, I mean, it's hard to speak definitively about such things, but what, under what circumstances is the morning after pill not merely a contraceptive, but an abortifacient?
Well, let me explain how it works. Contraception means against conception. In other words, to prevent fertilization taking place. We know that these high doses of hormones, same ones that are in birth control pill, but a much higher dose, prevents ovulation. If a woman is just about to ovulate, the egg coming out of the ovary, it can prevent that, and that's really contraceptive. It also can work by thickening the cervical mucus, which makes it difficult for the sperm to penetrate, and then fertilization doesn't take place. That's the way it works probably about 60% of the time. But if a woman has already ovulated in the last 72 hours when she takes that pill, what happens is fertilization takes place, but the pill actually affects the lining of the uterus and makes it so that that embryo cannot implant. And, of course, if that developing human being does not implant, it dies. So the way it works is part of the time actually causing the death of a human being.
The claim was made in that package that we played for you, Dr. Stevens, that by one of the representatives of this gynecological group, that the morning after pill, if made available over the counter, had the potential to reduce the number of abortions. She claimed it could reduce up to 50% of abortions that presently take place. How do you respond?
You notice she said estimate, and I think there's a few things you need to know. Number one, the new president of the American College OBGYN is a abortion advocate and has really been pushing the envelope. Those that are members are very concerned about what she's doing with the organization. Number two, the scientific studies don't support what she said. The definitive article is in the journal Contraception, and it's called the Glassner Study, and they found that there was no decrease in abortion rate when this was given to women before they thought they would need it. And everybody claimed that's what was going to happen, but when they actually studied this, they found there was actually no decrease in the abortion rate. And this study was done in England, where this has been available much longer than here. Also, they found in a different study that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association that there actually was no decrease in the pregnancy rates with advanced provision. The studies that they quote claiming that, you know, it decreases pregnancy by 80% was done in a very controlled population. But when done where this is just available over the counter in pharmacies, women didn't take it properly, they didn't take it soon enough, and all sorts of things, and they found that there really was no decrease in the pregnancy rate when someone was given able to get this at a pharmacy beforehand. So the scientific data doesn't support what they're saying. And what's going on, they're accusing the other side of politics, but some abortion advocates are playing politics with this, trying to get this over the counter. I think one of the questions we need to ask, American College OBGYN is giving out posters to 40,000 obstetrician and gynecologists, and I got to ask who's paying for that, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was the manufacturers of these pills.
Now, I'm thinking about the average OBGYN who wants nothing to do with abortion. A man or a woman who says, look, I'm in the business of seeing that the babies get born and doing the very best with the mother in that respect, and that works counter to what I am called to do. They hear that their organization, of which they might even be a member, the American College of OBGYN, has said, look, we need the morning after pill on the shelves. What does he do?
That's an interesting question, because my associate director here at the Christian Medical Association, Dr. Gene Rudd's an obstetrician gynecologist, he walked into my office saying the same thing this morning, saying, what do I do? I'm thinking about quitting. And, you know, and I think that's something that a lot of people are going to be considering, especially with kind of, they've been pretty radical, but under this new administration have even been more radical than before. And there already is an association of pro-life obstetrician and gynecologists made up of people who've left that organization, though there still are many doctors in the American College of OBGYN that are very pro-abortion. And part of the reason that is that it's very tough for a medical student to get into an OBGYN residency if they're not willing to do abortions. They screen them out. They make it very hostile for them if they do get in. So increasingly, that specialty is populated by abortion advocates who push this agenda.
That is, I've got a 14-year-old daughter, and I'm thinking about her growing into a woman, and she will eventually need to find an OBGYN on a regular basis. And that's scary for me as a father to think about her having to choose among medical school graduates who have, through the attrition or pressure, gone into that profession as advocates of abortion.
Well, by law, it's very well established, she can give your daughter birth control pills and not tell you. She can do abortion, or that doctor can do an abortion on your daughter and never tell you. She can give, emergency contraception to your daughter. Once she walks through that door into that OBGYN doctor's office, you really have little or no control what's going to happen. I think that's why it's so important for people to look for Christian physicians who share their worldview and their moral views for their family, especially for their daughters as they get into the reproductive years and need those type of services. Because if not, they can easily be influenced at a very vulnerable time to do something they're going to regret the rest of their lives.
Dr. Stevens, the voice of the American College of OBGYN carries a lot of weight. This, when we first heard this story, we were reviewing it before we went on air. My first question was, okay, which group is this? It wasn't very specific in the opening of the piece. And when I realized it was this, the premier group, I'm thinking to myself, my goodness, this is going to convince a lot of people. Do you think it will?
I think it's going to carry quite a bit of weight. Unfortunately, most people think of scientific organizations like the American College of OBGYN as unbiased and factual. Nothing could be further from the truth. And we're seeing this in specialty groups, not only that one, across the country, where they're becoming highly politicized, taken over by activist groups who've worked their way up through the structure, like this woman has, to get a very influential position to accomplish their agenda. And we're seeing it with homosexual activists, abortion activists, stem cell activists, where there's almost a hijacking of the credibility of a organization where they don't represent the majority of the members, but they get their agenda across. And once a resolution is passed or something like that, that becomes the official position. It carries weight in court, and it carries weight in the court of public opinion. And that's unfortunately what's happened with American College OBGYN.
Dr. David Stevens is our guest. He's executive director of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. We're talking about a campaign launched by the nation's largest gynecologist group aimed at increasing access to the morning after pill. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's May the 9th. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be hearing a Today Show interview with Joel Osteen during that audio open lines. Dr. Stevens, why does the FDA currently restrict the morning after pill to prescription only?
Well, they make it sound like that, you know, it's just politics. Actually, I have a good friend that served on the committee and was one of the votes that opposed this. It's highly politicized as well, the committee is, that looks at this for the FDA of experts. But the reason that they turned it down was, first of all, there was no studies done in the primary population that was going to use it. That's teenagers. Studies out of other countries have shown that the ones that use emergency contraception are usually in their young teens or 18 to 25 years of age. And there were not good studies, especially in 13 through 18-year-olds, showing how this would be used. Also, they noted that it was untested in repeated use. You can buy this over the counter, then you don't have any type of medical surveillance of what the effects of it are, and yet there's no studies that show if you use this again and again, you go out with your boyfriend this week and use it, and go out with your boyfriend and have sex and use it again next week, what happens when women use this as their primary form of contraception. Thirdly, there's lots of data out of Europe, India, and other countries showing that one of the primary purchasers of this when it's available over the counter is men, and what they were doing was purchasing it to cover up what they were doing with underage girls and incest and predatory sexual activity. And so the FDA had a significant amount of data which said, we don't have enough testing to show that this is safe, and we have some real concerns of what could happen socially, not only with this, but promoting promiscuity, promoting sexually transmitted disease. The other thing you got to understand, just like you mentioned for your daughter, Todd, the reason girls in their teenage years go to see a doctor usually is for pap smear or something doing with their reproduction. And if you make this available over the counter and you don't have to go get birth control pills, which is the main reason girls go to their doctor, then how are you going to screen girls for sexually transmitted disease that are promiscuous? So this makes it dangerous for girls. You may prevent the pregnancy, but they have gonorrhea and become infertile. And so it's a very serious concern, and that's why the FDA said, no, we're not going to put this across the counter next to the breath mints.
I'm just thinking about something you just mentioned, that, and if you just play the scenario, the likely scenario out in your mind, you've got a girl who is sexually active. She's, I would say, underage. I know that that seems so quaint nowadays to say such a thing, but a girl who is sexually active, she's a little hesitant to even go to her OBGYN and ask for contraception, so she just goes to the local Walgreens, picks up a couple boxes of the morning after pill and uses it, as you said, as her primary form of contraception. And these are high doses. And I think it's two pills that have to be taken at a certain time in conjunction with one another. And we're talking about a teenager here.
Yeah, there's some side effects because of the high doses. A lot of nausea and vomiting, about 25% Girls have to take some sort of nausea pill. They're vomiting so bad, which can continue for up to 2 weeks after taking this dose. Dizziness, headaches, spotting, fluid retention, all sorts of problems. But the biggest concern is that there's no studies to show what effect this has on the ovaries and reproduction when you're taking these high doses periodically every week or two. And studies just don't exist. The studies were done in a very controlled population that had come for gynecological services and very closely monitored. That's not the population that's going to be buying this across the counter.
Okay, answer this question for me. If you can get into the mind of the advocates for abortion in the American College of OBGYN, if these gynecologists and obstetricians can already just, if they want to, if they want their patients to have the morning after pill, they can write a prescription for the thing, why are they pushing for their, apparently on the part of their patients, for it to be over the counter?
Well, it's a feminist type of agenda issue more than a pro-abortion issue, because they would deny it's an abortifacient. But what they're saying is that women should have control, unlimited control of their own reproduction, and therefore they should have the right to make this decision if they want to make it. And they are so blinded to, you know, the fact that the problems could occur because of this overriding agenda that they're pushing this. Secondly, the Planned Parenthood and other groups are really pushing it because they're selling these pills and are associated with the companies that do, and they're making a lot of money off of this. So you're talking that 1.3 million women took it last year. What if you had 50 million women take it, 50 million doses next year? There's a lot of money to be made, and you always have to look under this issue who's going to benefit from the sale of this drug to trace it back to what the real roots are.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, where Randy is waiting in Warrenton. Randy, thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Hello. There?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, I'm a pharmacist, and I have a question about the birth control pills. I was that they have the four mechanisms of action of stopping pregnancy. Isn't birth control pills, can they do the same thing as these, even in a lower dosage?
Thank you very much, Randy. Good question. Dr. Stevens.
That's a roaring debate in the pro-life community, and it's been going on for a number of years. We actually, along with folks on the family, put together a group of scientists to actually look and review the literature. And bottom line is there's not good studies showing either way whether the regular birth control pills can work by preventing implantation. The physician desk reference actually says that. We actually went back to some of the scientists that helped prepare that. They didn't have studies to show it in those doses, but they assumed that it worked that way. So what we believe as Christian doctors is that we present the evidence, informed consent, letting people know there is a chance that birth control pills that you normally take could work in that manner. And you need to be aware of that when you make that decision, but we do not have evidence one way or another. A lot of inferences, a lot of people very adamant about their position, but scientifically we don't have good information to say one way or another. What do I do? My daughter just got married last summer, and after looking at the evidence, I have her and recommended to her that she go on low-dose birth control pills, not progesterone-only pills, but the combined pill, which there's pretty good evidence that they don't work by stopping pregnancy, but only through contraception.
And how is that different from the action and the evidence that there is for the morning-after pill?
Morning-after pill is given in a much higher dose, and has a much more profound effect on the lining of the uterus, which prevents implantation, and the studies are pretty conclusive there.
The College of OBGYN, the American College of OBGYN, they certainly are aware of the data. So why do they seem less concerned about the dangers?
Well, their big battle they're fighting is saying this is not abortifacient. If you put emergency contraception in the internet, you'll come up with all sorts of hits where they're saying it's not an abortifacient, it's not like RU486, which is the abortion pill. That's true, it's not. RU486 works by interrupting the blood supply to the placenta of the developing baby and causes its death. This works in a different way, but through verbal gymnastics, I think, better than anything else, they've defined those developing embryos out of existence and therefore are claiming what they're claiming. You need to understand, American College OBGYN gets a lot of its funding from pharmaceutical corporations, so they're working to keep people happy that are pushing this, as well as their own ideology.
Finally, with less than a minute, Dr. Stevens, how should someone understand the headlines that read, major OBGYN group advocates morning after pill over the counter?
I think in any head like that, you need to go to some trusted sources of scientists that have looked at this and can really give you unbiased data. And that could be either on our website, cmda.org, Focus on the Family's got good data with their Physicians Resource Council. And always look behind the news before you make a decision, because on these issues, you need to be suspect.
Dr. David Stevens is Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association, based in Bristol, Tennessee. You'll find resources like that on the Morning After Pill at their website, cmda.org. CMDA, it's the website for the Christian Medical and Dental Association, cmda.org. Dr. Stevens, thanks for being our guest again.
Great to be with you, and people can find a Christian doctor on that website as well.
Oh, that's good to know. Very good to know. When we come back from this break, we've got audio open lines for about a half hour. Very interesting little interview between Katie Couric and Joel Osteen this morning on the Today Show. Joel's writing a new book. He's got the largest advance, I think this is correct, the largest advance ever paid to any author ever in history for his next book. His last book was called Your Best Life Now. We've reviewed it. We've talked about it. We've reviewed Joel Osteen's sermons. His next book, I don't know what it's titled. It's scheduled to come out a year from now. $13 million in advance. Now, that tells you something. Publishers don't pay those kind of advances to anybody unless they're certain they're going to make every penny and more back. And they will. Joel Osteen is just about everywhere you look nowadays. And if you looked at the television this morning on the Today Show, you saw him there. We'll play that interview between Joel Osteen and Katie Couric. When we come back, it'll be audio open lines. I want your reaction to that and some other audio we have for you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our email is up and working, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We get it right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Then, at 4:30, Dr. Nathan Jastrom will join us to talk about Old Testament Saint Job. We'll kind of clear away the yes and the no of Job. Dr. Doug Grotheis will be our guest. He'll answer the question, how do you write a letter to the editor that not only makes it through the mail, but actually gets read, taken seriously, and maybe even published? And then in the last half hour, a little bit more audio open lines. 60 Minutes, Ed Bradley reports on the Priory of Zion, what the Da Vinci book says and the film says, as opposed to what the scholars, the real scholars, have to say. That's coming up in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Audio Open Lines is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.